Good morning, historians from around the internet. Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, where the goal is to just talk about history and, just spread some knowledge. So I'm learning stuff with you guys as I'm talking to you about it. So this is all really fun. So no news for Old History. I was featured in, my work found out about my history thing, and they wrote an article, and I was some kind of a showcase employee, and they sent like a little article about me and Old History to like every email company-wide in the nation. It's really cool. So other than that, no news. I haven't been anywhere. Kind of just taking a break, figuring out what I'm going to do next, what I'm going to film next. So, with all that being said, let's go ahead and take us just a real quick break here, and we'll get right into today's podcast. All right, so the topic for today's podcast is going to be, we're going to talk about Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. We'll also talk about the Bushwhackers and the Jayhawks, and the Bridge Burners, all the guerrilla warfare. So we'll talk about the Bridge Burners first, because that was an important part of the war. So we'll just touch on this. I'll go a little bit in depth into it, but for the most part, you guys probably know a lot about this already. So I don't know who wrote the article. It's somebody by the name of Bummer. From CivilWarBummer.com. It's an article they wrote on the Bridge Burners. So, early on in the war, the Tennessee Bridge Burners were a group of pro-Unionist soldiers, or people, just probably regular people, I don't know. The East Tennessee Bridge Burning was basically some very early guerrilla warfare. Was carried out by Union sympathizers in Confederate-occupied East Tennessee. Now, the operation was planned by Minister William B. Carter and was authorized by President Lincoln. The sabotage called for the destruction of 9 railroad bridges and an invasion of East Tennessee by Union forces from Kentucky. Now, while the conspirators managed to destroy 5 of the 9 targeted bridges, the federal government did not follow through with the military occupation, and many of the pro-Union conspirators were either imprisoned, banished, or hanged. Militarily, the East Tennessee campaigns really weren't any, they didn't bear any great significance in the war, but this was an important area in the war, don't get me wrong. This entire section of Tennessee was predominantly Union in its sympathies, because, as I've said before in a lot of other podcasts that I've made, other episodes, a lot of this area was pretty mountainous and rocky and, hilly. And there were farms here, but just not huge, enormous farms like you'll get out in West Tennessee and down into Georgia and the more southerly states with flatter land. So slave owners were here, but they weren't, it just wasn't common here because, mountain people were poor. We didn't have anything. Doesn't mean there weren't any. There just wasn't a lot of them. So, but anyway, especially when you get into upper Tennessee, when you get down around Knoxville, Sevierville, there were some bigger farms, some bigger producing plantations, but not up here in the state of Franklin area. So Tennessee seceded, as I said in the last episode, by like 20,000 votes in the eastern counties. They didn't even want anything to do with it. The people of East Tennessee kind of wanted to stay with the Union. So Parson Brownlow and Andrew Johnson were quick to point out that in effect, a free state was occupied by rebel forces. In the fall election, the three mountain congressional districts elected Union men. These men maintained they were members elect of the United States Congress, not of the Confederacy, and they left for Washington to occupy their seats. Only one of the congressmen succeeded in reaching the Capitol. Now, Washington was very aware of what was going on here in Tennessee, and Lincoln knew that an invasion of a Union army would arouse the population, and it would support the liberators. So the president was eager to send an army to free the pro-Union residents of Tennessee. So the bridge attacks were the brainchild of longtime Carter County resident, Reverend William Blunt Carter, in conjunction with his brother, General Samuel B. Carter. Mr. William Carter had traveled to Washington earlier in the year, where, at a meeting in the White House, he secured Union political and military support. And by October, he was recruiting Unionists as far south as Bridgeport, Alabama, and had developed several networks of saboteurs. The conspiracy went awry almost immediately on the night of November 8, 1861. The Chickamauga Creek and Hiwassee bridges were poorly guarded and were burned with minimal effort. The Bridgeport, Loudoun, and Watauga bridges were heavily guarded by Confederate soldiers, and conspirators abandoned attempts to destroy them. The Lick Creek and Union bridges were guarded by one or two sentries each, who were easily overpowered before setting fire to the bridges. At the Strawberry Plains Bridge, now there's a very, very famous image of that. It's claimed that the image, I'm sure everybody here, if you're listening to this, has seen it. I don't know the true story behind it. It's said that it was taken during a reenactment. It shows a soldier standing behind Fort upon the hill in Strawberry Plains. He's standing over the railroad bridge. But anyway, the crew encountered a lone Confederate guard, and when an attempt was made to light a torch, the saboteurs were spotted and attacked. Two were badly wounded, and the matches were lost, and they were unable to light a fire, and the group abandoned the mission and left for home. Confederate Secretary of State Judah Benjamin sent Colonel Danville Leadbetter to identify, jail, and hang as many participants in the bridge burning scheme as he could find, and then rebuild the bridges. And Benjamin's instructions stated, "I now proceed to give you the desired instruction in relation to the prisoners of war taken by you among the traitors of East Tennessee. First, all such," end quote, quote unquote, "first, all such as can be identified and having been engaged in bridge burning are to be tried summarily by drumhead courtial mart, and if found guilty, executed on the spot by hanging. It would be well to leave their bodies hanging in the vicinity of the burned bridges. Second, all such as have not been so engaged are to be treated as prisoners of war and sent with an armed guard to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. They are to be kept imprisoned at the depot selected by the government for prisoners of war." And so, we'll cut this off here, getting a little bit too deep into it, but the bridge burners stopped a lot of progress railroad-wise. I can't recall the name of it. It would have been the Clinchfield, Charleston, and something else. And it was supposed to go from somewhere over in Akron, North or South Carolina, across the mountains, come into Morristown, and then go on into Kentucky and Illinois. And it was going to be supposed to be the longest railroad on the Eastern Seaboard until that point, until they stopped it and the railroad company couldn't rebuild. I made a post about that on Facebook, so if you guys want to see it, send me a message and I will find it up for you. So anyway, there's a little bit on the bridge burners. We'll get into a little bit onto the guerrilla warfare as far as bushwhackers and Jayhawks, and then we'll talk about Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. So, and this is from the next three sections are going to be from battlefields.org, which is from the American Battlefield Trust. So this is heavily overshadowed by the bloody battles waged between large-scale armies. Guerrilla warfare tactics were employed. They would be employed by both the Union and the Confederacy at various points throughout the Civil War. And when you read between the lines, you'll see a lot of that going on. And this happened a lot, particularly in contested areas and border states, and with its deeply divided loyalties and dueling military presence. Missouri would be a hotbed of guerrilla activity early in the war, a situation that only intensified after the Battle of Wilson's Creek. So, and there were bushwhackers all over the place, not just in Missouri. This is just a good article. But in Missouri and other border states on the Western theater, guerrilla fighters, regardless of which side they favored, were commonly called bushwhackers, although pro-Union partisans were also known as Jayhawkers, a term that originated during the pre-war Bleeding Kansas period. And I might make a podcast on that later. Bleeding Kansas is an interesting topic. Guerrilla fighters could only loosely be called soldiers, as these small partisan bands acted independently outside of the framework of formal armies and command structures. Without actual or official uniforms, they presented challenges for opposing forces when captured. Should they be treated as enemy combatants or civilian criminals? Common tactics used by bushwhackers included ambushing individual families in smaller army detachments, or raiding small farms to steal supplies, ammunition, food, or whatever, what have you. And so that happened quite a bit. And in fact, there was a video I made on a guy somewhere up in Hawkins County, discussed his grave and where he was and how he died. So he was actually killed by bushwhackers, and the guy, I can't remember his name, was across the river on his father-in-law's farm when some bushwhackers came and killed, I believe, his father, him and his father-in-law and his brother, because he was a soldier or something along the lines. But anyway, that's just a little bit on both of those, and I regret that I can't talk a little bit more about it. But this, the bushwhackers, is you can equally make a whole separate section on what the bushwhackers and the Jayhawkers done, just as much as you can on the bridge burners, because that didn't just happen in Tennessee. So, all right. So first thing we'll talk about is, as far as Civil War battles, would be the Battle of Fort Henry. Now, we'll take a break here, and then we'll get into Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. All right, so the Battle of Fort Henry occurred. Oh, this is Fort Henry, Tennessee, by the way. Both of the next section, Fort Donelson, also occurred in Tennessee. So the Battle of Fort Henry, Tennessee, occurred as part of a Union plan to open a water route into the Confederate heartland by capturing Forts Henry and Fort Donelson. In January of 1862, Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant and Flag Officer Andrew Foote were commissioned to lead a joint expedition to seize the Twin Forts. So it involved Ulysses Grant, Andrew Foote, and Confederate Lloyd Tilghman, I believe how you say that. So General Albert Sidney Johnston was charged with the defense of the Confederate border between the North and South in the Western Theater. To the Union's advantage, Johnston had roughly set only 71,000 Confederate soldiers. Only 71,000 Confederate soldiers. And a cadre of unimpressive subordinates to employ for the defense of the key strategic positions. In Tennessee, Fort Henry was badly situated on a low bank of the Tennessee River and represented the weakest point in Johnston's defensive line. In early 1862, seeking to open river traffic on the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers, Federals targeted Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, capturing Fort Henry and its sister, Fort Donelson, some 5 miles 5 miles away, and this would split Johnson's defensive line in two while opening the rivers to the battle. Now, to begin with, this started on January 30th, 1862, when Ulysses Grant received the long-anticipated word that he and Flag Officer Andrew Foote would lead a joint expedition against the twin forts, Henry and Donelson. On February 2nd, 1862, Grant and Flag Officer Foote moved a force of 15,000 soldiers, 4 ironclads, and 3 timberclad ships toward Fort Henry. Some 3,000 Confederates commanded by Brigadier General Lloyd Tilghman manned the defenses of Fort Henry. Spirits of the Union ranks were high, but the situation inside Fort Henry was vastly different. Confederates under Tilghman were poorly armed, and many of them with flintlock rifles dating from the War of 1812. And the inclement weather had left many of them ill. So they were already at a pretty high disadvantage. So although Fort Henry's walls were, 20 feet high and 20 feet thick at the base, winter rains had swollen the river, leaving the parade ground submerged beneath 2 feet of water, and much of the powder in the magazines damp. I'm having a problem talking today. On February 4th and 5th, Grant's infantry disembarked out of range of Fort Henry's guns, and upon learning of the size and composition of the Union forces from scouts, Tilghman withdrew entirely from the incomplete walls of Fort Hyman on the west bank of the river, and dispatched the majority of the force inside Fort Henry, overland to the more defensible Fort Donelson. Still, he determined to make a stand against the coming gunboats rather than abandon Fort Henry to the enemy. And on noon, February 6, 1862, Foote would order his flotilla into position less than 300 yards from the fort. Grant's infantry was to come up behind the rear of the fort, while Foote's ships bombarded the fort from the river. The point-blank range battle wreaked havoc on the Confederates. Confederate cannoneers put up a fight against the flotilla of the gunboats, but it was not enough to do anything to the Union defense, or the Union offense, excuse me. Before long, all 4 of the fort's heavy guns had been lost, and 21 Southerners were casualties. A direct hit to the middle boiler knocked the ironclad USS Essex out of commission, causing 32 Union casualties in one shot and disabling her for the rest of the campaign. The Cincinnati took 32 hits and the St. Louis 7. And Confederates had the worst of it. Tilghman asked Foote for terms, and the Union sailors' response presaged Grant's. 10 days later at Fort Donelson, "Your surrender will be unconditional," quote unquote. In a ceremony on board the USS Cincinnati, 12 officers and 82 men surrendered, and Grant's infantry, slowed by muddy roads, arrived at the surrender. So obviously the Union won this. This is the surrender of Fort Henry. 63 total casualties, 42 Union and 21 Confederate. When Grant's infantry arrived a few hours later, they found a large quantity of provisions and 6 mobile cannons mired in the mud. Despite the limited scope of the battle and subsequent casualties, the fall of Fort Henry opened the Upper Tennessee to the Union and set the stage for the fall of Fort Donelson roughly 1 week later. The combined victories at Forts Henry and Donelson propelled Grant into national spotlight. Fort Henry was one of the first major Union victories in the war and had significant impacts on Union morale in the bleak months following the route of Bull Run and the defeat at Wilson's Creek. And so we'll move on. We'll go ahead and skip a week and go into the Battle of Fort Donelson. So after the fall of Fort Henry, General Grant would be determined to move quickly to capture the much larger Fort Donelson, located on the nearby Cumberland River. However, Grant's boast that he would take to Donelson by February 8th quickly ran into challenges. Poor winter weather late arriving reinforcements, and difficulties in moving the ironclad ships up the Cumberland River delayed Grant's advance on Fort Donelson. Despite his conviction that no earthen fort could withstand the power of the Union Army's gunboats, Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston allowed the garrison at Fort Donelson to remain and even sends new commanders and reinforcements there. By February the 11th, Johnston would appoint Brigadier General John B. Floyd as the commander of Fort Donelson and the surrounding region. Nearly 17,000 Confederate soldiers, combined with the improved artillery positions and earthworks, convinced Floyd that a hasty retreat is unnecessary. On February 14th, Flag Officer Andrew Foote's ironclads move upriver to bombard Fort Donelson. In the subsequent duel between Foote's poop turtles, as they're called, and the heavier guns on the fort, lead to a Union defeat. Many of Foote's ironclads are heavily damaged, and Foote himself would be wounded in the attack. Grant's soldiers hear the Confederate cheers as the gunboats withdraw, and while Grant contemplates an extended siege, the Confederate leadership devises a bold plan to mass their troops against the Union right to force an open path of escape. The next morning, February 15th, the Confederate assault strikes the Union and drives it back from its position on Dudley Hill. Brigadier General John McClernand attempts to reform its lines, but the ongoing rebel attacks continue to drive his forces southeast. The Union Army would retreat, but inexplicably, Confederate General Gideon Pillow, there are a lot of generals that were going on there, orders the attacking rebel force back to their earthworks, causing them to abandon the hog fart gains of the morning. Seizing an opportunity, General Grant ordered McClernand and General Lew Wallace to retake their lost ground, and then rides to the Union left to order an attack upon the Confederate works opposite to Brigadier General Charles F. Smith's division. Grant reasons correctly in that the Confederate right must be greatly reduced in strength given the heavy assault from the Confederate left. Smith's division surges forward and overwhelms the lone Confederate regiment occupying the rifle pits in advance of the Confederate line. The next morning, or the next 2 days, during the night, Confederate leaders discuss their options. Despite many disagreements, they determine that surrender is the only viable option for the garrison. Generals Floyd and Pillow abandon their men and flee across the river, while Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest, disgusted with the Confederate decision to surrender, takes his cavalrymen and escapes down the Charlotte Road. Even with these defections, more than 13,000 Confederate soldiers remain at the fort. Poised to strike again, the Federal soldiers are surprised to see white flags waving above the Confederate earthworks. Brigadier General Simon B. Buckner is now in command and meets with Grant to determine the terms of the surrender. So, in the exchange between the commanders, it grows more cordial when they meet face to face. In his memoirs, Grant looked back on the meeting with Buckner. In the course of our conversation, which was very friendly, he said to me that if he had been in command, I would not have got up Donelson so easily as I did. I told him that if he had been in command, I should not have tried it the way I did. I had invested their lines with a smaller force than they had to defend them, and at that same time had sent a brigade 5,000 strong around by the water. I had relied upon their commander to allow me to come satisfy safely outside of their works. Grant would eventually be promoted to Major General for his victories in Tennessee, and his subsequent success at Shiloh, Vicksburg, and Chattanooga earned him the rank of Lieutenant General and appointment as commander of all Union armies. The favorable outcome for the Union in the Civil War ultimately results in his election as President of the United States in 1868. And so this is just a couple Just a couple of more interesting facts about the Civil War. Hope somebody learned something. If you made it this far, please consider subscribing to the podcast. As always, thanks for listening. See you guys next weekend.